of the beautiful things about Pope St. Pius X, he was the pope who condemned modernism. He was the pope who lowered the age for First Holy Communion. He also was the pope who had the foresight to codify the code of canon law. Now, prior to Pope St. Pius X, the study of canon law, the laws of the church, was very cumbersome because you had multiple popes, you had multiple councils. The study of canon law was very, very burdensome, even for someone who had the time and had the wherewith to study. So St. Pius X, he ordered the codifications. We want all the laws of the church in one volume. Now, he died before it was completed, and Pope Benedict XV completed it, and it was done in 1917. It went into effect in 1918. There's 2,414 canons. But the beautiful thing is this. In the Code of Canon Law, you'll have footnotes. The footnotes are the references to where these laws came from. So you could look at a canon, and a canon 737 about baptism. It talks about how baptism is the gate to salvation. It opens the gate to the other sacraments, necessary for all men for salvation, either in fact, in reality, or at least in desire. It's canon 737. Now, interestingly, if you look up the footnotes that are the source for this canon, the footnotes are referencing the Council of Trent. The footnotes are referencing Pope Innocent III. And all those teachings of the popes that talked about baptism, or at least a desire for baptism. So I know, in this day and age, unfortunately, there's some people that still, unfortunately, follow the errors of Father Feeney and think there's no baptism of desire. The 1917 code references that right in the code. There's also another canon. That's on canon on burial. It said it's forbidden. You're not supposed to bury people who are not baptized except for catechumens. So when it comes to this canon 1239, it says catechumens who through no fault of their own die without baptism are given ecclesiastical burial. Now, this is very interesting because those who don't believe in baptism desire, this presents a problem. Because it's right there in the code, and the very things that we have been for years saying, that's what their church teaches, that what the church teaches, oh no, that's not proper interpretation. These canons show it right there. And the reference in the footnotes tells the source of these canons. Now, this is what, for those who do not believe in baptism of desire, what they're basically saying is that Pope Benedict the 15th erred, and all the bishops in union with him, and then the Pope after him, Pope Pius the 11th, he erred, and Pope Pius the 12th erred. And then somehow these people are so smart that they figured it out, that these are all mistakes and shouldn't have been done. I had heard, didn't read it, but I heard, and I don't doubt it, but I'm sure you've heard of the Diamond Brothers Holy Family Monastery. Now, I'm just saying I heard this. They don't believe in baptism, I know that. But they were saying, well, this code was not properly promulgated. That is preposterous. We just, in the seminary, we read the promulgation of the code written by Pope Benedict the 15th. Makes it very clear, this is the laws of the church. and this goes into effect in Pentecost of 1918. But the beautiful thing about our faith is that whether we look at the liturgy, whether we look at the teachings of the popes, we look at the teachings of the councils, we look at canon law, you see this wonderful harmony. And we were talking about divine revelation. Divine revelation, we find divine revelation in Scripture, the Bible, Old and New Testament, and also tradition. Now, I tell you something very interesting. I was having mass down in Kansas, and three young guys didn't know who they were. They showed up for mass, and they were invited by one of the parishioners, and they looked like Protestants. They had a Bible, and they had a Bible in their hand, and they had a beard. You know, they looked like one of the prophets. Looked like one of the apostles. So they made a good-looking Protestant, you know, whatever. So I wanted them to read something, and I asked them a couple questions, but one of the things was this. It's the celebration of Easter. I mean, it changes every year. Who came up with that? They don't have any clue. This came right from the apostles. And in fact, there was a thing around the year 150 AD. Pope St. Victor was asked by St. Polycarp the question of when to celebrate Easter. Now, who was St. Polycarp? He was the disciple of St. John the Apostle. And who was St. Polycarp's disciple? It was St. Irenaeus. But the question was because St. John was allowing the Jewish converts to celebrate Easter not on the Sunday, but right around the time of the Passover, but not on Sunday. And Pope St. Victor said, no, this celebration of Easter has to be on the Sunday following the first full moon of the vernal equinox. That is what has been established. It comes from Peter. Now, as late as 325 at the Council of Nicaea, besides the Council of Nicaea condemning Arius, who denied the divinity of Christ, the issue of Easter was a very important issue. And it was made very clear to Universal Church, it is going to be the Sunday. Christ rose from the dead on Sunday. Easter is going to be celebrated on Sunday after the first full moon of the vernal equinox. But when you study, this is the neat thing about our faith. When you study history, you're studying what really happened. I mean, the Protestants jumped from Jesus, the Bible, and here I am. But what about everything else? What was going on in the church after the time of Christ and the apostles? What was going on in the church? Most people didn't have a Bible. The Bible, as one volume, was not put together for centuries later. And then, not until the 1400s when the printing press was invented, most people didn't even have a Bible. How did they learn the faith? If you look at the history of the church that emanated from Christ, take, for example, St. Peter. St. Peter's successor was St. Linus and Cletus, Anacletus, Cletus. And then Cletus, it was St. Clement. Now, interestingly, in canon law, before we get into canon law, we go through the principles of canon law and principles of law itself. The first 86 canons are dealing with interpretation and definitions and all this stuff. And they're giving examples of how the sources of canon law are the popes and also the ecumenical councils. And they give one first example is Pope Clement. A controversy had arisen amongst the Corinthians. St. John, the apostle, was still alive, and he was much closer. But no, they referred the matter to Rome. And Pope Clement spoke as one having authority. Same thing with Pope St. Victor on the issue of Easter. He was speaking as one who had authority. This is a matter of history. This is not made up. This is a matter of fact. We can go to the catacombs. The catacombs, we're speaking about St. Cecilia, catacombs St. Calixtus. The catacombs of St. Calixtus are the catacombs of the popes. The popes that we know and honor, and we have their writings, are the popes that are buried there. Their sarcophagus, or sarcophagi, are right there, tells you about the popes. And in the catacombs, there's bishops, and there's priests, and there's deacons and subdeacons. And the St. Tarsicius, the saint of the Holy Eucharist, acolyte. It reminds me of something very interesting. Talked to this Orthodox young lady. Now, the Orthodox, they broke with the Catholic Church in 1054. And she was making an issue about communion just under one species, under the host. And she was saying, no, you got to receive under both species. I said, no, for the priest, yes, but for the lay people, no. And I gave as an example, in the early church, St. Tarsicius carried the Eucharist under the form of bread only to give to the faithful. When you receive under either species, you receive Christ whole and entire. But the beautiful thing about our faith is this. The more you study, the more you realize there's no contradictions, there's continuity, there's harmony from every aspect, every angle, and how wonderfully they all point to each other. They all come and fit together wonderfully. Now, this brings us to, and we're all down to 6 minutes here. I'm going to tell you a story about 6 minutes here. I like to make sure my sermons aren't too long. And it's hard when you have the gift of gab, and you also you're Italian. I'm half Italian, so I use my hands, and I get kind of excited, etc. But you're sometimes constrained. And I always like to, if I'm having 8 o'clock Mass, I'm done with the sermon by 8:30, period. If I'm having 10 o'clock Mass, I'm done by 10:30, period. Okay? And then I look at my watch, I got 2 minutes to wrap this sermon up. Watch. And then you try to go at it. So I wanted to say, with regard to a very important aspect that we should never forget about our faith is this. Christ established an infallible church. Christ said, when he said, go teach all nations, teaching them to observe everything I've commanded, he says, I am with you all days, even to the consummation of the world, even to the end of the world. Christ is with his church. Now that promise was made to his apostles and their successors. And when we look at the modern church, we do not see an infallible church. We see error. We see heresy. Not just in the teachings, but in the liturgy, in their canon law, permeated with religious indifferentism, false ecumenism, religious liberty, etc. And we got to remember that Christ's church is a visible church. You know it's a visible church. You can see externally. How do I know someone's a member of the church? First of all, they have to be baptized. And they also have to publicly profess the faith. Public profession. If they don't publicly profess the faith, how could they be a member of that church? And we're not talking about some gray areas. We're talking about some very, very clear-cut, black and white areas. I know we've spoken about this before, maybe some even heard this before or not, but I remember talking to someone and we went round and round and round and round. So I had just one question for them, because they were getting advice from some lay theologian. So my one question, I got one question. We're going to answer, we're going to end this on one question. I said, how can a Mass be valid without the consecration? Now, that's exactly what John Paul II had approved of with Cardinal, at that time, Ratzinger. They said Catholics can go to the Assyrian Church of the East even though they don't have a consecration. And that's a valid Mass. So I said, explain for me, how does that work? I mean, that's clear cut. And answer, we're with the Pope. Well, he's not the Pope. If he's Christ's representative, and Christ has established the Mass and the sacraments, it's not for the Church to change the substance, the matter and the form established by Christ in these matters. He has no authority over that. Just like he has no authority to tell everybody, you can worship with other religions, you can worship with other churches. The need of grace recommends it. Break the first commandment because the need of grace recommends it. No. They're not speaking for Christ. They're not a Christ representative. What they're binding is not binding in heaven. Binding in hell, but not binding in heaven. So, I know we've gone through these things in years past, etc., etc., but I would just like to recommend a couple of things. This might be helpful for y'all. A couple books here, right on the board here. Okay, we do not have a pope today, but the beautiful thing is that the popes before Vatican II left some very, very beautiful encyclical letters. So, one encyclical letter I think would be very nice for you to read is Pope Pius XI, Mortalium Animos. He talks about the very things that we've been speaking about with false ecumenism, religious differentism. Oh, I got another half hour. Hey, hit the jackpot here. Okay, another beautiful encyclical. Pope Pius the 12th. Mystici Corporis, and the mystical body of Christ. And then also, Mediator Dei. Another good one, we should have started off with this one. Pope Pius the 9th, the Syllabus of Error. Pope Pius the 9th, he had written 32 encyclicals, addresses, and all sorts of, you know, papal teachings, and he was concerned that all of his teachings had not gone to all the bishops of the world. So he did a summary of them, and the summary was made in the form of condemned propositions. I think there's like 76, 77, 78, 78 condemned propositions, maybe 79 condemned propositions. And then he gives the footnote, will tell you which one of these papal teachings that he made it refers to, so you go back to the original text. Now, Pope Pius the Ninth, when he came out with the Syllabus of Error, this was in 1864, this was a big stumbling block at Vatican II. Because the conservatives were saying, how can we teach today about religious liberty when it was condemned over 100 years ago, it was condemned in a Syllabus of Error? How can we reconcile the condemning of religious liberty and now we're going to teach it? So these are, I think, this would be very good. There's also a book, I didn't bring it down with me, but it's called The Fundamentals of Catholic Dogma. It's at the bookstore by Ludwig Ott. It's like an encyclopedia of what the Catholic Church teaches. This is a really, really good book. There's another good book at the Barry McIlwain Center, Moral Theology by Joan Allman. This has been reprinted I can't believe how many times it's been reprinted. Originally from the German. For a layperson, this has some very good information in it. Really good stuff. So I'd like to recommend these just as a help. Another really good book, the book My Catholic Faith. And if you're not good at reading, there's good pictures. Obviously, the Baltimore Catechism by Father Connell, Baltimore 3, good stuff. And it has also quotes from Scripture. There's a lot of good books, Catholic books out there. It's important for us to keep our our minds sharp when it comes to knowing our faith, to be able to explain our faith, and also to be able to defend our faith. So we're going to stand for the Angelus, and we'll give you a little break again. Has to deal with people that fall asleep when the bishop's talking, okay? But I'm not looking at any of you. One time, a bishop was going to give confirmation, and he's talking to all these little kids. You know, like most bishops, they get a little winded. And he goes from one topic to another, and now he's on the purgatory. And purgatory, that's not the most interesting thing, talking about purgatory and atonement for sins, and this little kid just going, bleh. This kid's in the land of Nod. So he's out. The bishop realizes, hey, he's sleeping. So he tells the pastor, he says, wake up, they could ask him a question. Last thing the kid heard was purgatory. So the priest says, what is the sacrament of matrimony? He says, Johnny, a place where you suffer before you go to heaven. So the priest said, Johnny, that's not right. Stay awake. And the bishop whispered to him, what do you know about it? Okay, you know, among the books that are really good, I think, to help us inspire us with the faith of our fathers, the book Victory of the Martyrs by St. Alphonsus Liguori. I got to tell you, there's some of our sisters in Minnesota broke down. We hand-me-down cars in Omaha. So we had a Toyota. Toyotas are great cars. It had over 420,000 miles on, and we were trying to go 500. I mean, it's like, yes. So it started to lose compression. It won't go any faster than 15 miles an hour. And the mechanic said, time to hang this one up, okay? But so the sisters broke down one time. I'm not sure if it was this Toyota or whatever. And it was Friday night. The mechanic places were closed. Who picks him up but this Protestant minister, Lutheran minister, and his daughter? And his daughter was about 19, and she was very curious about the sisters. So they were too far away from the convent, so they stayed overnight at the Lutheran minister's home. And they got his address, they got the girl's, name and address. They wanted to send her something that would be helpful. And I said, what would really be fascinating for her and for her dad is Victory of the Martyrs, because when you read the Victory of the Martyrs, you realize these people were Catholic. The early Christians were Catholics. The early Virgin Martyrs, the early popes, St. Lawrence, deacon, roasted on the gridiron. That's all history. I said, if they could only read this, they're going to realize, hey, long before the Lutherans ever came around in 1517 with Martin Luther, ex-priest, those early Christians were Catholic. This is a really good book. There's also, I'm not sure, sister here, do you have Martyrs of the Colosseum? That is a very good book. The only thing I don't like about the book is not the contents, great book stories, but the binding is like, sometimes they don't have very good binding and all of a sudden you have pages popping out like, couldn't it have done better? But, I mean, it's not your fault. You just buy the books, right? But Martyrs of the Colosseum, very, very fascinating, stuff. No. So, but you planted a seed, it's there. You never know, sometime down the line, something might all of a sudden click and make them think. Now, I wanted to tell you that, look at my watch here, in the world, there are people who are pessimists. How many have ever met a pessimist before? Okay. Everything is negative. I got to tell you a fishing story about a pessimist. I took a pessimist fishing one time. First of all, the pessimist told me, I'm not going to catch anything. I never do. It's not me. I don't know. Might be a lucky day. So we're going fishing. There's three or four of us. The pessimist says, I don't want to catch anything. All of a sudden, they're getting a bite. We're in a boat. They're getting a bite. And he's going to probably eat my bait. I don't know. He might swallow it, too. It might hook him. Worth a try. I got him. He's on. He's probably going to get off. But don't stop now. Finally get the fish in a boat. Look at how small it is. Take the fish, smack. That's a pessimist. I mean, You know, it's always looking at the dark side of things. Then you have people who are optimists. You know, things could be going terribly wrong, and they're just so optimistic, nothing's going to happen. There's two types of people in the world, optimists, pessimists. But you know what I think we should try to be, especially in our own times, we need to be realists. Look at things the way they really are. And not only that, but realize that God is in charge. So realists are going to say, things are really bad in society today. That's being honest. Just looking at it as it really is. We have the upcoming elections and the instability that's already going on in a lot of our major democratic cities with the rioting and protesting and damage of property, and these people that are rioting and doing all this damage, they're let off. I read this morning, I think 72% of those getting arrested are let go. Just let off scot-free because these democratic George Soros paid for district attorneys that has let them go. Not good, because then it's just a free stamp. Go ahead and do it some more. Doesn't look good. And what's going to happen at the election? I don't know. It's in God's hands. And it could be a contested election. That would be really ugly, too, because if there'd be bickering and has to go to court, you know, that could lead to civil unrest, too. And it could be very, this is not just talk. It's real. But the bottom line is we need to remind ourselves that God is in charge. And we also, for this whole COVID thing of the shutdowns, and you've got to shut the church down, you can only have 5 people or 10 people, whatever, and the penalty is attached. It's kind of a foretaste of, hey, we might be into some real trouble in the future. Just like in Mexico about 100 years ago, Catholics were persecuted in Mexico for their Catholic faith. The Cristeros came to the defense of the church. Priests had to go in hiding. Priests were put to death. Which reminds me, I don't want to go into something too profane, but when I was in Guadalajara for ordinations and for confirmation, this older couple took me to a tequila factory. Now, why I say this could keep you awake, okay? I knew enough Spanish when we went on the tour. We went down into the cellar, and the tour guide said, this is a tunnel that the Cristeros used to go from the church to the tequila factory, and the church was about a block away, underground tunnel all the way there. So for those of you who enjoy a little bit of tequila every once in a while, Jose Cuervo tequila, they were Cristeros, they were Catholics. So I'm just telling you that. This is just a little, don't write it down, just keep it back in mind. But bottom line is this. Not too long ago, people were being put to death. They were being put to death for their faith down in Mexico. And we know on communist countries, the communists will target religious and clergy and those who have any influence on people. I was looking this up in the, looking up the stats for since 1917 when Lenin and Trotsky overcame and took over Russia, established USSR, Soviet Union. From 1917 to the present date, they estimate at least 100 million people were put to death under communism. I know we're throwing a lot of things at you because we're running out of time, but there is one, you can look it up on YouTube, on the internet, Anarchy USA, a documentary on the 1960s, Anarchy USA. It's amazing because I saw that when I was a little boy. They're showing stuff that I remember when I was a little kid growing up in South Side of Chicago. We had race riots. We had burnings and looting and all sorts of stuff like that. But in Anarchy USA, they're interviewing former communists. These were black people who said, we were trained in Moscow. We were trained to create civil unrest, find some type of a cause, agitate the people, get them to protest, and then you can rile them up, then get them to start damaging property and setting things on fire, and then start damaging and hurting people. And the communist plan was, this is part of Marxist communism. Communism is based on atheism, collectivism, no private property, class struggle. That's how they bring the country down. Create civil unrest, just bring down the authority, and then they take over. But when you watch this Anarchy USA, you're thinking, this is exactly the game plan they're doing right now. One of the parts of the game plan was discredit the police. that was this this movie, I think it was 1968, and you're looking and thinking, this is happening today. It's just a different game plan. It's a different time, but the same game plan, I should say. I also have to say this. Remember September 11th attack? I mean, you know, everything's going on nice and hunky-dory, and all of a sudden, the Twin Towers come down. And listen, we're not going to go into who did it and what it was all about, but shocking, was it not? I mean, just, it was, you're just blown away that something like this could happen, and life changed. But the thing interesting about that time, what year was it? September 11th, 2000 and what? 2001. Back then, police and firemen were respected. They were heroes. They were people that you just thought, they risked their lives, so those people, some of them died going up into those towers. 19 years later, we have civil unrest, and the policemen and these people and law enforcement are the bad guys. Now, do some of them make mistakes? Yes. Sometimes they have to make a split decision. Not easy. But they, the communists, know how to exploit a situation, create a popular movement, and then from there create that class struggle. But I would like to just say what's going on in our country today, no different than what's happened in the past. I found it interesting. I get this magazine called Nebraska Land, and it has things on hunting, fishing, and the outdoors in Nebraska. A lot of colorful pictures, a lot of good articles for the kids to read in school. And they said in, what was it? It was the 1920s. Now, where's Dave? You know, Loop City. Loop City had a riot. Did you ever hear this riot in Loop City? I never heard of it either. There was some type of agitation going on, and maybe it was 1930s, but it was like down at the time of the Depression. This one woman, communist, went there and agitated people. There was a big riot in Loop City. And I'm thinking, the communists were doing it even back then. It's crazy. But they know the game plan. You know, you get this. Also, I find interesting, we've all talked about before, trying to think of the woman who converted from communism to Catholic faith, Bella Dodd. Bella Dodd, we read her work, it was like the School of Darkness. She talks about working with the school unions, the teacher unions, and stuff like that. Now, I find it interesting, one of our parishioners, she is a refugee from communist Cuba, and she came and talked to our kids about what life was like under Fidel Castro and communism, etc., how bad it was. She said, you can't believe it today, but I'm a substitute teacher. When I go into the schools, I see pictures of communists and Marxists on the walls. We are dealing with, unfortunately, something that's been around for a long time, and that is the brainwashing of our young people for years. You look at some of these people that are demonstrating and protesting and doing the crazy stuff, they come from very affluent families. They've been brainwashed to think, oh, this is a movement, this is cool. They come from very much privileged families, and what they're doing, that's just the communist plot. Get people who have no clue what's going on, get them involved to make it sound very popular, make it sound like, oh, this is a great cause, and we need to all stand behind it and all that other stuff, as if we're going to bring about justice by doing injustice. We're going to try to straighten things out by damaging and destroying and burning and looting and attacking people. Crazy. So we're in very, very strange times, for sure. But I think, you know, our country morally has been decaying for a long time, and that's exactly what the communists like to do. Break down the morality of people, because when you break down the morality of them, it'll be a lot easier to take them over, to control them. So what the future has, I don't know. I don't like to be a pessimist. I don't like to be an optimist. I like to be a realist. I would say an optimistic realist. God's in charge. Our Lady will crush the head of Satan. But that doesn't mean we're not going to be persecuted. It doesn't mean that we might not suffer for our faith. That could very easily possibly happen. So the thing is, now, while we have the time, we make ourselves available with the sacraments. I don't know, everyone comes from a different state, and there was all sorts of different regulations on the regard to the restrictions, health restrictions, but I think it was a good wake-up call when, you know, you can only have 10 people in church, and we'd have to have 6 masses on the weekend, and we were putting people in a choir loft, choir room, hall, church, outside the church, you know, trying to get everybody to make it to mass. People would start realizing, boy, I was taking lip mass for granted. I mean, I was taking it for like, yeah, it's going to always be there. No, it may not always be there. So appreciate the mass and sacraments when you have it. And not just on Sundays, but when you can go do in a week, of course, take advantage of that, especially first Fridays, first Saturdays, etc. And when we don't have the mass and sacraments, remember, be faithful to praying a rosary and wearing a brown scapular. Now, it's 12:19, so I have 12 minutes to answer anybody's questions. Good, no questions? Yes. Yes, okay. Okay, so the issue is this. There's two things I want to talk about here. It'll be very brief. But summary. And you know that book, Fundamentals of Catholic Dogma, was a little bit odd. He has a really good section on that. And you know, I know it's warm up there and they talk real fast. I'm going to use red marker to keep you awake now, okay? So, with regard to the object of infallibility, the primary object is sacred scripture and tradition. The secondary object of infallibility are those things closely associated with divine revelation. I'll give you some examples. The liturgy, as we pray, so we believe. Universal laws of the church, those affect us. Those are the things we have to live by. These are all covered under infallibility. Canonization of saints. So as an example, Father Francis Connell in his Outlines of Moral Theology talks about St. Francis Xavier Cabrini. She was canonized as of late. That she's in heaven, that's an infallible act when the Pope canonizes somebody. Pope can't err in that. However, if you deny something that is in this area here, if the Catholic Church has defined something, they call it divine and Catholic faith. Divine meaning revealed by God, Catholic faith meaning the Church says this is divinely revealed. If you deny something in this category, you're a heretic. If you deny something in this area here, it's a mortal sin. So, also, the religious orders to come under this category. But we're doing this very rapidly. Father Connell speaks about how ex cathedra, what does that term mean? It means from the chair, when the Pope's speaking as the supreme head of the church. And even in an encyclical, the Pope can speak ex cathedra. Father Connell makes it very clear. What is it? What was the reason that he used that terminology? They're showing that the Pope is speaking as the supreme head of the church, man is a faith and morals, and he's binding the faithful. You have to believe this. This is it. Some have tried to narrow infallibility to some rare, very rare occasion. No. And the thing about it is this. We can make a list of many things that came forth from the Vatican II, the modern church, but I'll give you one. And this was when it came to the preface to the Novus Ordo. The new mass. It was number 7 of the preface. It said, define the mass. The mass is the gathering together of the people of God. I'm trying to go too fast, not coming up legibly. With the priest presiding. To celebrate the memorial of the Lord. Where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst. This is not the Mass. Just because people get together, I mean, we get together in honor of Christ, and Christ might be spiritually amongst us, but that's not the Mass. The priest could have Mass with just a server, and there's no gathering of the people of God. Christ is present because the priest who represents Christ through his ordination, he acts in the person of Christ, says, this is my body, this is the chalice of my blood. This is all typical of a Protestant gathering where two or three are gathered in my name, they're in the midst. That has nothing to do with the Mass. You follow? And yet this was the official definition of the Mass. We also know, too, when it comes to Father Bennett, I'm sure covered this, the case for the state of his position, but when it comes to manifest heresy, if the Pope were to fall into manifest heresy, he would lose the papacy. I found it interesting, 5 minutes, there was this Novus Ordo Bishop, Snyder. Anybody here, Bishop Snyder? Yeah, okay. He's going to go to the conservative one. So he recognizes the problems in the church, but what he says, and he quotes erroneously, that, oh, there's been heretical popes in the past. He uses Pope Liberius and Pope Honorius. Those things were refuted at Vatican I. They were not heretics. They didn't fall into heresy. And for him to try to say, well, there's nothing you can do. They fall into heresy, nothing you can do about it. That's totally erroneous. But unfortunately, people look to him and think, well, he can recognize the problems. But we have to stay within this structure. No. So I know we're down to 4 minutes, but was there any other questions? Yeah, back there. Forgive me. What's your name again? Stacy. Okay, that's an interesting question. I'll tell you this, I won't say where, I just had, right before COVID hit, I was trying to get as many places in for confirmations, and I talked to this grandma. She came up to me after Mass and was asking for prayers for her granddaughter. And I had confirmed her like maybe 11 years ago, 12 years ago. I said, well, sure, I pray for her. How's she doing? Not good. I said, what's the scoop? She said, she thinks she's a he. So I said, well, you know what? I'd like to just talk to her. So I said, why don't you ask if she, tomorrow, I'll be here tomorrow morning after Mass, go out for breakfast and just talk to her. So they actually went to Mass. So I was kind of looking for, so next to Grandma was this person in a suit coat, short hair, not as short as mine, but pretty short, and just trying to be someone they're not. And, you know, at no time did I ever make reference that she was a he. And talked to her about the importance of praying and doing God's will and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I wanted to break the ice because there's definitely be follow-up. Like we're saying, with any type of conversion, it takes time. Now, for me, I believe what is the final thing I want to do is convert them, get them out of this situation. And I hadn't seen this person for 12 years. It's not like all of a sudden I'm going to come in here like a game buster, condemn them and walk away and just think, well, I told her off. some of these things are emotional issues. I read something. Father Benedict actually had a great book on this. Talk about people not born that way. But something happens, especially in their adolescence, where they are emotionally hurt, and they tend to go in a wrong direction like that, and a lot of them can come back. So, you know, it's just a matter of every situation is different. It takes a lot of prudence. You don't want to compromise, of course, never compromise, but you also have to be charitable, kind, and try to win them, especially by prayer. And if you can get them to pray, because, you know, everything we're saying about, oh, study this, read that, this, you could talk about this, talk about that. If God's grace isn't there, they're not going to see it. So, very important they pray. Get them to pray. I know one story, I've told this before in sermons. There was one place I didn't go to very often for confirmations. And so this couple picks me up and have a nice dinner with them. And it was a Saturday night. And I just asked them, how about their children? You know, what their children up to? I mentioned, oh, one of our daughters, she's been away from the church. She's into drugs, really bad, into drugs. So I said, listen, I don't come here very often, but I got my prayers prayed. Where does she live? Does she have an apartment? Yeah, but she's probably at work. I don't care what goes to see her at work. Well, I don't know, maybe she wouldn't see her. I said, let's give it a try. You know, they don't come here hardly ever. So we went to her work. She was a waitress. And the timing was, it couldn't have been any better. So he goes in there. This girl was heavy on drugs. I mean, can't describe other than to say very thin, bags under her eyes, very gaunt. That's a good word. I was trying to find the right word, gaunt. And as soon as she came out, he went in and says, hey, Bishop's here for confirmations. He just wanted to say hello. She just walks out, and she just starts profusely crying. And I called her by her first name. I said, listen, I know you feel stuck. You look like you're a beaten dog. But you can do better than this, kid. You can do way better than this. So I said, I got something for you. Would you put this on? She didn't hesitate to put that scapular on. I mean, just put it on right away. And while she's crying, I said, listen, I promise to pray for you. And I just wanted to ask you, would you just pray to Mary, just three Hail Marys every day, ask Mary to help you. You can do better than what you're doing. But she had already reached rock bottom. I could just tell. And within, I'm not exaggerating, within 2 weeks, she was off the drugs, never went to rehab, off the drugs, and back to church. That's God's grace. It's nothing to do with me or anything I said. She put that scapular on, she prayed those Hail Marys. So that's what we got to get people to do, is to pray. And try our best to, you know, even if it's, you don't have to pray a lot, but just anything. We read in the glories of Mary, but still not the glory, how little sometimes people did to honor the Virgin Mary, and our Blessed Mother will just reward them abundantly. So get the person to pray. That'd be important, you know, and it starts somewhere. No matter how basic it is, get them to pray. If they can pray, God's grace is going to start working on them. And I believe not only that, but divine providence let things happen and fall into place that all of a sudden they start seeing the hand of God in their life. Like, they get scared, like, my gosh, how did this happen? How did that happen? You know, God does love me. God does care for me. You know, that type of thing. And some people give up. You know, just think, well, I'm just a hopeless cause and the heck with it. So, Father and I are staring at me. It's not polite to stare, Father. Oh, now you got his glasses on. Oh, he's really staring. Okay, Father, Father Fahm's ready? Okay, 20-minute break. Thank you for listening. You've been very kind. God bless you, too.